the important races in South Florida beyond the presidency, the need for human touch, and a collection of Keys photography. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. We're less than a week away, and though much of the attention for this election is normally on the presidential candidates, there are key races across South Florida getting a lot of attention. We'll look at some of those congressional races and why we might be rethinking the idea of vote by mail. Also, human touch is vital to the survival of a newborn baby. It's also critical for our emotional health. But the pandemic has forced us to keep a distance from each other. We'll look at a new study on the effects of lack of touch. And finally, when the Keys closed itself off to the world back in March, a group of photographers started to document life in Key West. We'll learn about life on the isolated island. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, as the election season enters its final days, the campaigns are ratcheting up their get-out-the-vote efforts here in the Sunshine State. President Trump is in Tampa tomorrow for a rally, and Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden will also be in Tampa Thursday. Former presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg is stumping on his behalf today. Aside from the presidential race, there are a number of congressional races in South Florida that are getting a lot of national attention. I mean, millions of dollars are being spent to flip key districts across the state. Susan McManus is the University of South Florida political science professor emeritus. She's been following Florida politics for decades and will explain how the 2020 election is turning out to be one like none other. Susan, always great to have you. Thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me. Yeah, what a race.
Well, you know, so I got to start with this. I always keep hearing, and I think I've always been saying, this is the most important election of our lives. Is that just the case? Every election is going to be the most important of our lives? Is that what you think?
Well, I think this one really is in the minds of a lot, as best exhibited by the huge turnout that we're seeing so far. A lot of people think that their vote really is going to matter this time.
And yeah, as of this morning, close to 4 million ballots have already been cast in Florida for this election, including early voting and vote by mail. What do you make of the turnout so far at this point in the election compared to years past?
Obviously, the volume is very impressive. And of course, the vote patterns, I think we've well established the fact that Democrats really encourage people to vote by mail, and Republicans stressing more in-person early voting or election day voting. Particularly the vote by mail is a flip from in the past when it was largely Republicans pushing that more than Democrats who were pushing more early in-person voting.
Yeah, we expected Democrats to have an advantage in the vote by mail due to the fact that the president's rhetoric is constantly attacked. But how has that constant attack on the practice changed people's views of vote by mail? And how, where did that switch come from? What, from Republicans to Democrats as to who was doing it more?
Obviously, the party really pushed, Democrats really, really pushed hard to vote by mail. And Republicans, the reverse, in sync with sort of what the president was saying. But all along, he did say that vote by mail is in better shape here than in some other states where it's the first time that they've actually engaged in the magnitude of vote by mail as we're seeing this election cycle. But, you know, in terms of interpreting what it means, I know there's a lot of emphasis. You can't pick up any, tweet or any source without looking at, well, the party, this party's ahead or this party's losing, that kind of thing. But I think what people are really forgetting is the fact that 26% of our registered voters are no party affiliation, and it's really hard to know in which direction they are going to vote. Some people say it will be a heavily Democratic vote. Others say, well, no, the better approach is to use a 50-50 split when you're trying to project because of the different configurations of people who do choose to register as NPA. But it certainly created a lot of excitement. On the other hand, if you haven't voted, you've probably seen more contacts or will by the time Election Day comes than you've ever seen in your life.
Probably I've already voted, but I think I can agree with that. You know, I want to look at one group, the young voter. turnout. And in 2016, less than 50% of voters 18 to 29 participated in the election. What are we seeing so far?
It looks like that's going to be a pattern that's reversed, and there's some reasons for it. First of all, Florida's younger, two youngest generations, that would be Gen Zers and Millennials, it would be the 18 to 39-year-olds, now comprise almost one-third of our current registered voters. And around a third of them have registered as no party affiliation. They're not enamored of either party, and their rationale is that, looking at Congress, that nothing's been done, neither party can reach across the aisle. Meanwhile, big problems are plaguing not only they, but their family. But here's another thing that I think makes the likelihood that you're going to see a higher turnout among these two generations, particularly Gen Z, this time out in the past, is because we have had an awful lot of activism on issues among Florida's young population.
Yeah.
Starting with Parkland, but including big, big issues, climate change being one, racial and social justice another, representational equity for women in the job market, etc. A lot of issues pushing them, and they've been very, very active. A lot of protests, a lot of marches, and it looks like this may be the year that that activism translates into votes. It'll be very interesting. And if it does, that will certainly change the long-term face of Florida politics.
It's interesting that you say that the turnout for that young vote is reversing. It's going higher, because one of the issues that we heard from FIU professor Daniel Evans, who's been following the youth vote, is that there was a concern that the closure of college campuses as voting locations could be a problem, but I guess not.
Well, that we're going to see, because it is true that they are being targeted by social media. The question is the effectiveness of it, because what I'm hearing from some of the college students that I still interface with is they're going to absolutely pull their hair out if they get one more text on their phone. They really equate them with robocalls, but social media is something that young voters are also quickly able to sort through and discount if they don't want to look at it. Half a second or less it takes. But it does appear that social media, not Facebook, because that's an older demographic reached by that, but more things like Snapchat and Instagram and TikTok, for example, and different ways of communicating with them to engage them. They're a very visual generation, so short videos, memes, things of that nature are much more effective than what middle-aged or older people would describe as social media. And it is the case that if they're going to turn out at higher rates, that it most likely will be attributable to the fact that this online social media contacting is replacing the activism, the collective activism on college campuses that used to be the case from the boomers till probably the Gen Xers, but maybe it's no longer true.
All right. So obviously there's the presidential race. We all know Trump, Biden, but there are also a lot of congressional races because both sides are fighting for control of Congress. So let's take a look at Congressional District 26 here in South Florida. Very expensive. Lots of money put into this one. Incumbent Democrat Debbie McCarcel Powell facing against Republican Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez. Why is this race generated so much interest nationally?
I think for two reasons. The fact that there's a female incumbent in the position is generating a lot of interest and a lot of money from Democrats across the country. And this time out, we're seeing a lot more women donate to campaigns than we've ever seen before. And a lot of that is explained by the fact that more women are in professional positions, and even the younger women, particularly women of color, are interested in contributing, even if it's a small amount. So that's some of it. But the other is that this was once a Republican district, and Democrats captured it, and Republicans would like to gain it back. Then, of course, you have some of the Latino issues on it, Cuban versus Ecuadorian. That's kind of interesting, because we're seeing countries of origin mattering a little bit more in how people within those communities are choosing their presidential candidate this time out. But this is a really, really expensive race, and it, as you say, is a very nationalized race.
We've spoken with Mayor Jimenez and Congresswoman McCarcel Powell numerous times on the program. One of the key issues is for this campaign is the response to the pandemic. Here's Mayor Jimenez on this program back in May defending the reopening of restaurants at 50% capacity.
The risk is never going to be zero. Never. But we have to start opening up our economy and reduce the risk. And so we felt that the risk was low in this case, and you're always going to find a case where something happens somewhere around the world. It's never going to be perfect here or anywhere around the world. You have to take the measures which lessen the risk significantly, and the measures that we've taken lessen the risk significantly, but there's never going to be a zero risk. Anytime you step outside, you know, you're putting yourself at risk.
And then Congresswoman McCarcel Powell, running on her record in her time in Congress, in particular, her support in the passage of the HEROES Act. This is back in May as well.
The HEROES Act made some important changes to the PPP program after two rounds of funding it. It extends the covered period of the loan until December 31st. A lot of companies and businesses have been saying that if this expires in June, they're not going to be able to use all those funds by June, so they wouldn't be eligible for the loan to become a grant. We've extended that until December 31st. A lot of these small businesses have actually lost their employees. They want to rehire them, but many of them have not been able to come back to work. So we're allowing those small businesses to stay afloat by giving them more flexibility.
All right. So Susan, do either of these candidates have an advantage with that group you just mentioned, the no party affiliation, on their COVID response?
I think a lot of that has to do with the no party affiliation, the age and the circumstance of the individual. But for example, this is shaping up, I think, statewide, the biggest sort of divide that we're seeing among voters who have yet to vote. They're looking at things like one candidate or one party reflecting more the idea of lockdown or shutdowns for COVID. And the other is looking more at, you know, not shutting down and jobs. So I think this is a big divide right now, is the shutdown versus the jobs dimension to politics. But here, both of these were addressing small business owners, and they are important, but there are a lot of just everyday NPA young people in particular that the more significant thing in their minds is they don't want to see things shut down because it affects their lifestyle a lot. And so you have that kind of dimension to it. You have an age dimension over it, and you have a life circumstance dimension to it.
And of course, here we are facing a rise in COVID cases again. Again, I'm speaking with University of South Florida political science professor emerita Susan McManus, joining us via Skype. We are following some of the key congressional races here in Florida. Again, the election just around the corner. And read more of the election coverage, by the way, at WLRN.org. Let me move to Palm Beach County. You've got Republican Laura Loomer challenging incumbent Lois Frankel, heavily Democratic county, but Loomer has become a high-profile candidate. She was a social media, influencer, I guess, and she got a lot of support from Trump. Is this race a pulse check on the appetite for fringe candidates?
I see it more as a generational divide. And the typical thing for younger candidates to be bolder and to utilize social media more effectively and not being timid or, in any way. And that's sort of what Loomer has reflected. Those kind of candidates, whether it's Democrat or Republican, are appearing all over this country and other parts of the state because younger people are running for office at record levels, and their whole style and demeanor and how they campaign is very different. Now, in the case of Loomer, yes, she has gotten the support of the president, but Lois Frankel is, that's a very Democratic district, excuse me. I think it will be hard for Loomer to beat her, but it's gotten a lot of attention. and in some ways bolstered younger Republicans who feel like they haven't had a voice, or they want people who are not afraid to say that they're Republican and that they view XYZ. So it's gotten a lot of attention, but I don't think it's nearly gotten the attention as the Jimenez-McCarthy-Powell race.
Yeah. So, Susan, Florida has always been a critical swing state for the presidency. Maybe not as much in 2016, though. I mean, Trump won in the northern and midwestern states, some of the states that Obama had taken. Still, the candidates are spending a lot of time and money here, especially in South Florida. Is Florida still that important, or can you get away with just, say, win Michigan, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and you're good?
Well, it is even more important in some ways, because it's very difficult to say that either of the candidates is going to run the straight in the Midwest. And consequently, of course, Trump absolutely must have Florida. He cannot make the White House again without Florida. But, you know, you might wonder about Biden. Biden really wants to win Florida for several reasons. One is he, too, is some states that, you know, are a little bit iffy. So this would be a good chunk of change, 29 electoral college votes, to, you know, deflect any losses he might find in some other places that are tight right now. But I think equally important is that Biden recognizes that this is a year where coattails might really make a difference in terms of bolstering representation of Democrats in the state legislature and in the congressional delegation in particular, which is right now the congressional delegation is 14 Republicans and 13 Democrats, and a flip of a seat and you have a different configuration of the delegation. And if it did by some circumstance go to the House of Representatives, for we couldn't get a plurality of the 270, and when it went to the House of Representatives, who controls the delegation would probably make a lot of difference in, you know, whether the state went for red or blue in terms of casting its one vote that it gets under those circumstances. A lot of reasons for both of those candidates to be spending tomorrow in Tampa.
Yeah.
In the I-4 corridor. And of course, both of them have repeatedly been in South Florida, along with some major surrogates for each of them.
Yeah. And you were recently part of a pre-election conference with other swing states. I'm wondering, how are they viewing us? How are they viewing Florida?
They're very, very curious. I was interested to see how much they would be asking about. They did ask a lot about the Latina vote in Florida. And of course, the voting, people still have some imagery that we have the old, you know, hanging chads. There's that legacy. They were very interested in the closeness of Florida and why. And as academics, very, very interested in Florida's changing racial and ethnic composition and some of the schisms within particularly Latino groups, as well as even within blacks, a big question mark is whether we'll see greater gains by Republicans among that community this time. So I think race and ethnicity is always a generator of interest in academic world. And in the other swing states, none of them have either the age or the racial and ethnic diversity that does Florida.
All right. The other thing, though, the reason I asked that question, too, is because we're Florida and we had the 2000 election. We had the 2018 recounts. You know, we're Florida. People want to make fun of us. So what do you think? How confident are you next week that Florida doesn't become national news again?
Well, we will always be national news.
All right,
the degree
in a bad way.
To which somebody else will get more attention than us.
Okay.
You know, I think that there's a concern among a lot of, or hope among a lot of the county supervisors, that Florida's way ahead of the game in terms of rules for recount, rules for counting of ballots, ability to run all of these vote by mail and early vote through machines earlier so that we're not left counting 5 days after. Will there be some problems? Oh, sure. When you have people and equipment, you have issues. But I don't expect overall that there will be the degree of problems in Florida that we've seen in the 2000 election.
Yeah.
It would be great if we could shake that image of Florida, for a change.
Well, either we are or we're going to be the jokes of many late night shows again. Again, talking with University of South Florida political science professor emeritus Susan McManus via Skype. Again, follow all of our election coverage on election night at WLRN.org or on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Susan, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for the time.
Thank you.
All right. Still to come. How important is human touch to our mental health? That's coming up next.
She's a bright star, shining in a dark sky.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Think about the last time you hugged someone who is not in your COVID bubble. Maybe it was a family member that you haven't seen because of social distancing, maybe even a stranger. It's been months since health experts cautioned us against touching our faces, hugging, and shaking hands to avoid the spread of COVID-19. And that's not changing anytime soon, as the virus continues to spread and there's no vaccine. How do we navigate this new contact-free world? And what impact could the loss of touch have on our health? We're joined now by Dr. Tiffany Field. She is the director of the Touch Research Institute at the University of Miami. Dr. Field, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
You know, we're months into this COVID-19 and the social distancing. I'm wondering, what do you miss most about just everyday human touch?
What do I miss most? I miss it terribly, but I'm trying very hard to compensate by doing lots of exercise, which we actually did a COVID-19 survey and found that about 60% of people were saying they were touch deprived. But what seems to lessen that is people doing exercise and people having a routine. So I'm trying to do that.
How does the impact of touch, how does touch impact our physical and mental health? Like, I was thinking about this, and it's not as often as I'm used to. I don't get to touch people, but even a simple handshake, pat on the back, a hug, but it affects us in a lot of ways, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And what seems to be the mechanism is that when you move the skin, either, you know, a handshake or a hug or a back rub or even various forms of exercise, that slows down the nervous system and it slows down the production of stress hormones. And when that happens, it saves immune cells that fight off viral and bacterial cells. So it's ironic that at a very time when we really need a strong immune system, things like the absence of touch is basically hurting our immune system. And so we need to do whatever we can to move the skin. And so that's why I'm recommending various forms of exercise.
So that's the physical side. What about the mental health side? Just the thought, the idea that we can have human contact.
Yes, exactly. Well, in our survey, for example, the touch deprivation was highly related to depression, to anxiety, to sleep disturbances, even to post-traumatic stress symptoms. So it does have very serious effects. And what seemed to be related also was being lonely and feeling isolated. And even if people are living together, there was a sense of loneliness and isolation because of the lack of touch. What I expected to see was that there would be more touching within families, with partners and with children. And in fact, we found very low levels of people reporting that they touched their children a lot. There were only 21% that they were touching their partner a lot, only 33%. So I would encourage people within families to be giving back rubs on a daily basis.
A back rub a day is not a bad thing. You know, in history, have we ever been as touch deprived as we are during this pandemic?
Well, I was doing a study before this pandemic with my students in airport gates. And what we were looking at was social interaction. And what it turned out to be was we were looking at social media in these airport gate studies where people are waiting for airplanes. We noted that 98% of the time they're on their cell phones. And so there was very little touch going on. So I think that we've been moving away from touch, starting with social media. And now this is just the COVID-19 is aggravating it.
So social, not just social media, technology is keeping us from touching each other anyway. The pandemic's just added to that. Is there something to the American culture, though, you know, that's different? We talk about this here in the newsroom. Like, you know, I mean, look, I living in Miami, you know, I've talked to a lot of different Latin groups about this because there's so much hugging and kissing that we love to do just to say hi. And I'm wondering if there's something to cultural reasons for that.
Yes, certainly. And maybe Miami is exceptional because we do have a lot of people of Latin origin that are basically very, very touchy-feely. But our culture in general, the American culture, and I think there's only one worse culture, which is Great Britain and Australia, New Zealand. Those are the places I'm getting most of the press calls from because they feel they're being touch deprived, but they're even less touchy-feely than we are in the U.S. When we compare people in Miami with people in Paris, however, there's more physical affection in Paris and there's less verbal and physical aggression in Paris than in Miami. So there are certainly cultural differences, and we're somewhere along that continuum.
You talked about your study and you had said the word touch deprived. Can you elaborate on that? What does that mean?
Well, basically, it's what people are feeling when they can't greet people the way they normally do in social settings, like hugging and shaking hands. But also, just in close family situations, if you aren't touching each other, if you aren't holding each other, if you aren't hugging each other and back rubbing, then you're going to be touch deprived. And the first symptom of that is getting sick. The other symptom is getting more aggressive. And ultimately, with extreme touch deprivation in places like Romanian orphanages, those children fail to thrive.
I'm talking with Dr. Tiffany Field. She's the director of the Touch Research Institute at the University of Miami. And we're talking about the study that looks at the physical and mental health risks that we face when we have a lack of human touch in our lives. And that's being exacerbated by the pandemic, which, of course, forces us into social distancing. You know, there was a 2013 study that found that touch was the most important nonverbal behavior in nursing profession, especially when treating older folks. And of course, many of us have been socially isolated from our grandparents and loved ones because we have to keep them safe from COVID. What can we do to help the elderly to stay safe, but also to make sure that they're not touch deprived?
Yes, well, we started out being most concerned about the elderly, and especially the elderly living alone. It turns out in our study that it's the young living alone that are more deprived than the elderly. And I believe it's because the elderly have learned how to deal with having less touch. And one of those things may be just simply walking around in their places. I agree with you. I think that grandparents are really struggling with not seeing their grandchildren. And you know, people are trying to compensate by doing things like Zoom sessions with grandparents and throwing them kisses and virtual hugs and so forth. But is anything we can do to help folks get through this and find ways to substitute for the touch that we're missing is going to be helpful.
Yeah, how do we do it? Because, I mean, yeah, we live in this world of Zoom calls and, you know, the video conference calls, and we're not in the same room together. We're not close to each other. But what advice do you have for people to cope with this touch deprivation?
Well, I'm saying within families, be sure everyone gets a back rub every day. And kids can give their parents back rubs. That's very easy. And everybody knows how to do that. With the elderly living alone, I'm saying you need to do things like walk around and even just laying on a bed and rolling back and forth, even sitting and crossing your legs and swinging your legs is going to be stimulating your legs. Even washing your hands, like we've all been washing our hands a lot, that's stimulating a lot of pressure receptors, and that gets the stimulation that we need. So I'm just saying, try to be as active as you can. Don't be sitting around too much, because you need that activity to as a substitute for the touch.
And you said a moment ago, which actually I find fascinating, that older folks may have gotten used to being alone and not touching much. Is there a concern that then that people are just going to, because of this pandemic and we don't know how long it's going to last, that people are just going to get used to being alone and not touching?
Well, I think the used to be alone is resulting in the older people having a routine, the older people getting exercise and finding ways to compensate for their not being touched. So that's what we're seeing, at least in our survey, that those people are not feeling as touch deprived as the young people who are used to getting a lot of touch.
Where else is this research going? What else are you looking into?
Well, we're trying to, we are very frustrated by the gradual disappearance of touch, because we know how important it is. And so we're studying alternative forms, like yoga is a growing phenomenon. People are spending a lot of time on Zoom yoga, and yoga is a form of self-massage. And so we're trying to teach people self-massage and how to provide their own touch if they are deprived of touch from others, in addition to, of course, encouraging families to spend a lot of time touching. And so we hope to be researching that. What are people doing? What are they actually doing during COVID, rather than just what they're reporting?
Yeah, human touch, it's important. Dr. Tiffany Field, Director of the Touch Research Institute at the University of Miami. Dr. Field, thank you so much for the insight.
Thank you.
And again, just think about it. We need the human touch every now and then. So if you're with your family, like she said, a back rub a day, not a bad idea. Still to come, a collection of photographs that show Key West during the pandemic shutdown in a new book. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, back in March, Florida shut down all non-essential businesses and put the tourism industry in lockdown as the state braced for the pandemic. The Florida Keys took the extra measure of shutting down the overseas highway. Only people who lived, owned property, or worked in the Keys were allowed to drive in. The normally bustling Duval Street in Key West, filled with thousands of visitors from all over the world, went quiet. This went on for months. The highway was reopened June 1st. The new photography book, Isolated Island, captures life in our southernmost point in the early days of the pandemic. Photographer and curator Roberta DePiero was the brainchild behind the book. She collected pictures from dozens of photographers in the Keys, including Mark Hedden. Mark and Roberta join us now. Mark, Roberta, thank you so much for the time.
Yeah, you're
Thanks,
welcome.
How are you doing?
So what happened? Let's go back to the beginning when the shutdown began. What happened in the Keys that moment? Did everything literally just stop, lights off, everybody went home? Roberto, I mean, was it just like a movie?
It was kind of eerie down here, because it felt just like after hurricane, when it was so quiet down here. And I actually just took to my bicycle and started riding around and noticed, you know, how beautiful everything was. I wanted to go down and see the southernmost point all covered up. And, you know, I wanted to see things that you normally can't get to because there's so many tourists down here.
Mark, what did you do in those first couple of days when everything stopped?
I also did a lot of riding around on my bike and just kind of looking at things. It's kind of a weird duality because, you know, the island is kind of great when there's not a lot of tourists here, but also a lot of people you know aren't making their living, which they need to get by.
Yeah.
So kind of that duality, well, boy, this is really fun, and this is also really terrible for a lot of people.
No, this is a fascinating dichotomy because, yeah, as you said, this is an island that needs the visitors, but, man, it's beautiful when nothing's happening, as the pictures show. Roberta, this is a photography book that includes work from a lot of different photographers. What's the story, you know, in this collection? What is it you're trying to tell?
Well, I had been out shooting pictures and posting on Facebook, and I noticed there were other photographers that were out shooting also and posting on Facebook. And I got in touch with Carol Tedesco, who she and I had previously collaborated on another photo book called Afterlife Images in the Key West Cemetery, to see if she wanted to maybe think about doing a book about this time in our history down here in Key West. And we decided we wanted to concentrate on just from March 1st to June 1st, which is when we literally were closed off from the rest of the world. And we wanted to invite other photographers to participate with us. So we ended up with 25 other photographers besides Carol and I. And they all knew that the shots had to be taken in that time period, and they each submitted up to 14 images.
And it is a massive book of beautiful photographs. And just a note, the proceeds from this book go to the Sister Season Fund, right?
That's correct. The proceeds will be going all to Sister Season Fund, which is a organization down here in Key West that helps to provide rent and utility help for people that are out of work. It started because people might have been out of work because of injuries or surgery, and they were recovering so that they could help pay their rent. But now they're opening it up to all service industry workers.
So flipping through this book, there was, I mean, again, so many beautiful books, pictures, I should say. One that jumped out at me, this one I think is from the photographer Liz Akar. I hope I'm saying her name right. It's an empty Duval Street, except for this, I think it's a rooster, if I'm not mistaken, and six little chickies trying to keep up. And it was just perfect because you have the loneliness of the pandemic, but also it almost felt like nature was stretching itself out, saying, oh, this is kind of nice. I mean, Mark, you're you know, nature lover, photographer. I'm wondering, did you get that sense like nature kind of enjoyed the quiet?
Yeah, I don't want to go down the rabbit hole of whether roosters count as nature. That's a whole other debate. But it was. I mean, my day job is with the Audubon Society. And so, you know, there were a lot of birds. This actually happened. The early part was during a big bird migration when everything's heading north. And all these birds are coming up from the Caribbean and South America, and they're working up to North America. So there were just birds everywhere, which is great, except most of the parks were shut down. So that was a little frustrating. But I was getting, you know, Facebook messages and emails all the time. It's like, oh my God, there's so many birds around. And you're like, there's probably this normal number of birds around. They're just feeling a little more free because there's less activity. And also people were walking and riding their bikes and noticing more.
Well, first of all, I think you probably just started a fight with anybody who loves roosters, but I'm just going to leave it at that. Did you notice, like, was it easier for you as a photographer because there was just more opportunity? Because, again, less humans, nature may have decided to come out a little bit more.
It was a little bit easier. I mean, it's almost, you know, like things were abandoned, things were empty. And that's kind of, you have to kind of recalibrate how you look at things when you're doing that. And then, you know, but then we had stuff like that big, we had a unity march after the George Floyd thing. And, you know, there were, what, 500,000 people? I'm not sure. I don't know what the numbers of the march were. But, you know, it was a lot of people out in public. And it was the first time a lot of people had seen that many people. And everyone was really responsible and masked up. But it was still kind of, you hadn't seen a lot of people for a while. And then there was this big event.
Yeah. You know, going again, looking at all the different types of photos that you have, because it's a massive collection, again, of nature, of humans, of empty streets and so forth. One of the ones, of course, is sunsets, which is something that's very famous in Key West. Roberta, why was the sunset shot so important, and why is it linked to Key West?
Well, I think it's linked to Key West because everyone goes down to Mallory Square to watch sunset, and it's just become – that kind of a thing down here to go and watch sunset, but they're always so beautiful down here. I know Heather Dowd did an entire section of just different sunsets from Bay of Honda all the way down to Key West from different spots, and it's just beautiful what her sunsets look like.
There was also, you also had a collection of photographs that were aerial photographs, which gave a really unique perspective of the shutdown, because from up above, you don't get the sense of that kind of loneliness. Everything looks peaceful.
Right. Right, and that was an interesting story. So, you know, Lewis, we asked every photographer to write their bio in first person and talk about, you know, what they felt during that time and to kind of explain their photos. So in the book, you meet Mark Head and you see his headshot, and then it follows with his photos. So Kyle Campbell, in his, he's the one that did all those drone shots. He got FAA approval to fly his drone while he was down here because he was out of work. He was non-essential, but he came back to visit his mom down here and was able to get those great shots. I mean, I have never seen the lighthouse like he got it from above.
Yeah, like I said, it just gives you a very different perspective of things from up above. Again, I'm talking with photographers Roberto DePiero and Mark Hedden. Their images are included in the new book, Isolated Island, which captures life in Key West in the early days of the pandemic. You could see some of the photos in the book and find more information on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Mark, oh, this is great. You had some pictures, and it goes back to a story I remember we played here on WLRN of a high school graduation that took place out in the water, and students were on jet skis going out getting their diplomas. Take us back to that day. It was so fascinating.
Yeah, it was actually one of those things you heard about through the grapevine, and Somerset Island Prep is kind of a small charter school in town, and I think they probably had like 15 kids graduating, and they just kind of thought, how do we make this special for them? And you know, the jet skis weren't getting used by tourists right then, so they had a boat on offshore, and each of the kids got on the jet ski and rode out there, and someone handed them actually Tom Rompella, the principal, handed them the diploma with a grabber, so he was 4 feet away, and I think it just, you know, turned what could have been a kind of dismal non-event into a great event in everybody's life. And it was just really great to see people out doing that. Everyone was masked. Everyone was socially distanced. It was just a really kind of cool thing. And the families were down on the dock. It was nice.
Mark, where were you positioned in you know, during that photo shoot?
Well, since I'm a bird photographer, I have a 400 millimeter lens. So I was on shore.
Oh, okay. I was just picturing you perhaps on the jet ski following them out there.
despite living in the Keys for 30 years, I've never ridden a jet ski. Wow. But no, we shot, there's a pier down at the end of the street, and we just kind of all stood there, and I shot from there.
Okay, so. You know what? We just learned something new about Mark and everybody. He's never been on a jet ski. All right. By the way, did you get a chance to talk to any of the students, socially distanced, of course, just to ask them how they felt about that?
I didn't actually, because they were kind of far away. So it was a little bit of a, you know, the usual kind of COVID weirdness of you're watching things remotely.
Yeah.
I think my wife might have interviewed a couple of them, but I did not.
Yeah. Nope. I remember that story. It was a lot of fun. Just the idea of it. I'm just a little jealous.
Yeah, no, it was great. I the school asked if they could use the photos, and I said, sure. And they went all over there on like people.com and I think The Guardian and all sorts of crazy places.
Roberta, you have these gorgeous underwater photos in the book, and that also just gave me this that paradox of like the chaotic life we humans have up top, and yet underneath the surface, nature just keeps on going. Those are gorgeous. How did you decide that you wanted to add those?
Well, that actually was Carol Tedesco. I wanted to invite Oslam and Joe Berg, who are underwater photographers, to be part of this. And that is actually what they submitted, was all underwater shots between Luke Key and the Vandenberg. And those are beautiful. And then Corey Malcolm also submitted above ground and below the water images that he shot right off of Higgs Beach. It was so amazing to me because the water got so clear during that time without cruise ships coming in, and it was calm down here. And so his shots are just amazing. But it really was what each photographer wanted to submit. It was their story of what they wanted to tell during those 3 months of the shutdown.
And Roberta, too, the other thing is this. So you have all these pictures of empty streets and a lot more nature, but you also have pictures, because Mark touched on this, pictures of life after things started to reopen slowly. There were protests the people who wanted things to reopen faster. You had the Black Lives Matter march. Why add those photos?
Important. Originally, we had cut it off on March on the 31st, but we realized that we wanted to include that march because that was an important time for us down here. You know, because like Mark said, it was the first big event. And so we told everyone they could submit through the 1st. And so there are several photographers that did give us images from that march.
And, you know, by the way, it's not just beautiful photos of sunsets and underwater photos or of nature, but again, as you mentioned earlier, it's this dichotomy, you know, it's you had pictures of the empty businesses and how people were struggling. How does the book explore that idea? And I'm wondering, how are they doing? Is everybody kind of getting back to normal?
Well, the book doesn't really explore the idea of that, but it gives you the opportunity for you to explore it in your mind to see what people actually went through. I mean, we have pictures that Rob O'Neill submitted, a picture that he shot on St. Patrick's Day at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon at one of the local bars down here. And then he shot it 1 hour after the 5 o'clock mandatory closing where no one was in it. So it was packed to the gills with revelers. And then right underneath it, you see the same shot taken from the same location, but with only the bartender in there wiping down the bar. So, you know, you really get to see, you know, because there are some because we didn't close until the 22nd of March. So there's quite a few pictures from that March 1st to the 22nd. You can see how vibrant everything was with the spring breakers down here and everything.
Yeah.
But.
And Mark, you touched on this a little while ago, again, because you were at the march that happened and hundreds of people out there. You go a while used to just quiet and emptiness, and then all of a sudden a whole bunch of people show up. How did everybody feel, you know, about that idea? Just being, again, it's a dangerous time, but everybody's in a crowd.
Everyone's in a crowd, but, I mean, people did spread out. You know, there was 6 foot distance, you know, unless I think people in their COVID bubble probably spent time immediately near each other. But everyone was masked. Everyone was respectful. You know, this is a small town, so we tend to work to get along pretty well, and that's what happened there. But you know, it was, you know, I think I don't think anyone was talking about that during the march, but I think everyone was kind of feeling it.
Yeah.
You know, this kind of notion of, oh my God, I'm around people again.
Let me ask both of you this as we wrap up: is you both have lived in the Keys for a while? I want to know, what do you think this era? How will we remember what we've been through, this pandemic? Roberta, let me start with you.
Great, thanks. Gosh, that's a tough one. It's kind of, I feel like those of us that have been here, and Mark, you might agree because you've been here this long too, those of us that have gone through Wilma and Irma and George and now the COVID, it kind of really weaves us together even more as we all become stronger for having lived through it. And I think that the community will be stronger once we all get back to whenever that's going to be, to more of a reality than it is. But I understand there are a lot of tourists in town, so that's good also.
Yeah.
Mark, what do you think?
Yeah.
I'm not sure what I'm going to take away from this. You know, it's a weird time, and I predicting anything at this point is kind of crazy. But, you know, I think I remember the solitude a little bit. So, you know, the fact that you kind of reflect on, all right, what am I really doing with my life? Because you've got some downtime to do it. It's like, you know, the bustle that's usually driving along, at least, you know, if it didn't disappear, it, you know, dissipated to a great extent. So I think that's kind of, everyone's kind of like, okay, trying to figure out what they're really doing with their lives. That's my guess. I mean, Key West is going through a thing right now with deciding whether we want to continue to have large cruise ships come here, and we have a big boat going on. And that's kind of the big conversation in town is, you know, can we survive as a tourist economy without them?
Yeah.
And we've been without them since the pandemic, so.
2020 is just going to be one of those years we all just look back on and go, wow, okay. Again, talking with photographers Roberta DePiero and Mark Hedden, you can find more information about this new book of photography, Isolated Island. It's on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Check out some of the photos. Roberta, Mark. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks,
Thank you so much.
And that is our program for this Wednesday, October 28th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, The Cuban vote has always played an important role in Florida elections. There are generational divides across party lines, but things are looking different in 2020 compared to 2016. We're going to hear from New York Times reporter Patty Mazzei, who's been speaking with Cuban voters across the region. And a reminder, this month for the Sundial Book Club, we have been reading In the Land of Good Living by Kent Russell. Russell and his friends walked the entire state of Florida back in 2016 and documented that experience. From the Panhandle down to Miami, they walked it. You can hear our interview with Kent and join the Sundial Book Club. Just go to Facebook and look up Sundial Book Club. We'd love to have you. And you've been hearing music all show from singer-songwriter Adrian Z. Adrian is based in Key West and has been performing throughout the Keys for decades. She's one of our Live from the 305 musicians for Season 3, a music series highlighting our local talent. We'll be launching Season 3 later this year. As always, remember, you can find all your election coverage, all your election information at WLRN.org. Follow us throughout on election night. We'll keep you up to date on what's going on. Find us here on Sundial on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial, or email us sundial@WLRNnews.org. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.